Hello and welcome to Paradox Podcast, episode 34. This one is on Colossians 1. Yes, a brand new series on Colossians. And the title is, Sorry God, This Wedding is for Corporeal Beings Only. Now, you may or may not know this, but I get the opportunity to speak a lot to a lot of different people. And because of this, I have to speak on a lot of different things. And so a question I'm often asked is, where do your sermons come from? Well, I'd like to tell you where they come from. They come from a coffee shop in Redlands called Augie's. Just about every weekday morning, you can find me there studying, preparing, writing, doing the best I can in order to bring some sort of insight or thought to the word of the Bible. And there was one day, just a few weeks ago, I was sitting there and I was working with my headphones off and I was working on a sermon and I overheard a conversation and a girl was recounting what happened to her during the weekend. And this girl was recounting the events of this weekend to her friends that were also girls. And she said these words to her friends. I went to a wedding last weekend, and it was so godly. Now, the word godly is a rather strange adjective to use to describe a wedding. After all, what makes a wedding godly or ungodly? Because if you are telling your friends that you went to a godly wedding, you are essentially saying that most weddings you go to are ungodly. And as I began to think about godly and ungodly weddings, I began to think of my friend's wedding that I had just attended this past summer. My friend Tyler, who's a professed agnostic, got married to his now wife, a woman named Eileen. And it was an interesting wedding to behold. I was a groomsman, and it was great to be a part of it. And when you compare and contrast that with my wedding, and I am a professed Christian, and you compare the differences, you realize that there are some major differences between Craig and Kimmy's wedding and Tyler and Eileen's wedding. Namely, at my wedding, it was officiated by an ordained minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ. At Tyler and Eileen's wedding, their officiant was a set designer for ABC's show The Bachelor, which is kind of awesome. At our wedding, there was prayer that was offered. At Tyler and Eileen's wedding, there was no prayer. At our wedding, God was credited for bringing my wife and I together. It was actually mentioned during the prayer. And at Tyler and Eileen's wedding, there was no mention of God whatsoever. And at our wedding, there were readings from the Holy Bible. And at Tyler and Eileen's wedding, there were readings from the astronomer Carl Sagan. And I don't know if you know who Carl Sagan is, but let's just say he's not really on board with the whole God, Jesus, religion thing. And so you compare and contrast these weddings with one another, and it would seem that one could be described as godly and one could be described as ungodly. But it doesn't stop there, because when I was telling Tyler about this conversation I overheard at Augie's and said, can you believe that this woman describes some weddings as godly and some as ungodly? Tyler said, well, our wedding was ungodly. And I said, well, how do you know? He said, well, only corporeal beings were invited. Now, I am not as smart as Tyler, so I had to look up the word corporeal. And as I looked it up, the dictionary definition is of or relating to a person's body, especially as opposed to their spirit, having a body. In other words, Tyler said, unless you have a body, you're not invited. Therefore, God, no body, not invited. So Tyler himself would even admit that his wedding was, quote unquote, ungodly. Which brings us back to this statement, this idea that a wedding can be so godly. And we have to ask what kind of theology informs that idea. Quite simply, most Christians in the United States of America believe that there are the ways of God and there are the ways of this world. And the wedding of Craig and Kimmy was a wedding of God, and the wedding of Tyler and Eileen was a wedding of this world. Now, why does this matter? And why is it that Christians group things into the ways of God or the ways of this world? Well, it's because most Christians believe that spiritual maturity, being able to grow in your own faith, is the ability to discern between worldly things and godly things. And so a Christian is able to call out what is godly and what is worldly, and then a mature Christian will be able to choose more godly things than worldly things in his or her life. So for instance, when you talk about books and writings, there are godly writings like the Holy Bible, and there are worldly writings, like the writings of Carl Sagan. Christians will also point out that there is godly music, like Hillsong United, and there is worldly music, like Jay-Z. And if you were to go to a Hillsong concert and feel this emotional connection to the performers and the other audience members, Christians would say that is God. But if you were to go to a Jay-Z concert and feel the same connection and the same emotion in the same kind of setting, they would point to that and say, well, that is the devil. How do we know? Because there is godly music and there is worldly music. There's also godly and worldly movies. For instance, just a few years ago, a movie called God's Not Dead came out across the theaters, and people would often say, it's just so good to be able to say amen in a theater. But when you look at worldly movies, like the movie called Magnolia, which came out in 1999, starring Tom Cruise, among a whole other list of amazing actors and actresses, when you look at the film Magnolia, it's instantly labeled as worldly. Why? There's no mention of God in it whatsoever. So if you are moved or inspired or challenged by Magnolia, it is always lesser than God's Not Dead, because God's Not Dead is a godly movie. And so when we think about all of these different things, whether it's weddings, music, writings, or movies, the truth is most Christians believe that spiritual maturity is the ability to discern between worldly things and godly things. Now, this may sound like a new debate, but it's nothing new. Because thousands of years ago, people from Colossae were struggling with the exact same question. Now, Colossae is in what is now modern-day Turkey. And Colossians was written to the people of Colossae by a man named Paul. Now, it's important for us to remember that the book of Colossians was not written for us in 2016 on the opposite side of the globe in California. No, the book of Colossians was written for the people of Colossae because they were known as the Colossians. Now, it's important for us to remember that the Colossians were real people struggling with real issues at a very real time. The main issue they were facing was that all of these religious people had heard about these new converts to religion, to monotheism. And so all of this old guard came to them and essentially said, look, we know how monotheism works, and this is what's important. You need to show that you are devoted to the one true God. In other words, the old guard said to the new believers, they said to them these words, you need to become spiritually mature. At this point, the new believers would hear these words and say, yes, I want to do it. I want to show that I am devoted to this God. I have changed my life because I believe in this God so much. Tell me what I must do to become spiritually mature. And so the old guard would tell them, we have this symbol that has been handed down from generation to generation to generation. We'd like for you to participate in that with us. And the new believer would say, yes, of course, what is this symbol? And the old guard would say, we need to take your genitals and cut off the foreskin so that you can participate in the miracle of circumcision. So now the question became, wait, why do I need to do that? Because circumcision involves a lot of pain, obviously. So what's the purpose behind all of this? And the response from the old guard was, well, we've always done this, and this is the final step to show your true devotion to God. There was a lot of tension between the traditions of old and the ability to be welcoming to the new. And so this question arose from Colossae, what is spiritual maturity? What does it really mean to grow in one's faith? Now, our modern day answer is that most Christians believe that spiritual maturity is being able to discern between worldly things and godly things. But Paul hears this question from across the lands and gives quite a different answer. Now, Paul's answer to the question, what is spiritual maturity, is the thesis statement of Colossians. But in order to get to the thesis statement, Paul believes it's necessary for the people of Colossae to understand who this Jesus Christ is and how Jesus Christ changes all of their theology and spirituality. And so Paul writes in Colossians 1:15-20, the introduction to the thesis statement. Paul says, He, Jesus Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created. Things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, all things have been created through him and for him. Jesus himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in all things. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace through the blood of his cross. In other words, Paul writes, remember this, Jesus Christ has created everything around you, and everything created around you is for Jesus Christ. Now, this flies in the face of our understanding today of what spiritual maturity is. Remember, most Christians today think that spiritual maturity is the ability to discern and decide between worldly things and godly things. But here's Paul saying there is no such thing as worldly things and godly things. They're all godly. God is everywhere. Jesus is, after all, found in all things. It's like Christians today take Colossians 1 and they change the words. Rather than reading all things, they change so many of Paul's word to some things. Let's read it with replacing all with some. Imagine if Paul wrote this, how different things would be. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him some things in heaven and on earth were created, some things visible and invisible. Whether some thrones or dominions or some rulers or powers, some things have been created through him and for him. How much does that change everything? The idea that there is worldly things and godly things is anti-Colossians. You cannot hold Colossians up as scripture and accept that there are worldly things and godly things. No, instead we have to get rid of all of that. And we have to ask the really tough question. Is God really present in some, or is God present in all? Because if God is present in all, then that means God is just as present in the writings of Scripture as God is present in the writings of Carl Sagan. If God is present in all, then that means if you go to a Hillsong concert, then God is there. But if you were to go to a Jay-Z concert the next weekend, then God would be just as present, just as available, just as much there as God was at the Hillsong concert. If God is present in not some, but all, then God is found just as much in the movie God's Not Dead as the movie Magnolia. And Magnolia, while it's rated R, is one of the best films I have seen about forgiveness. And if God is not present in some, but God is present in all, then what does that mean? Well, it means that Craig and Kimmy's wedding was just as godly as Eileen and Tyler's wedding. Think about that for a moment. If you really believe that God isn't present everywhere, then you believe in a very small God. And if you believe that Tyler and Eileen can exclude God from their wedding because they don't read from a book, then you believe in an even smaller God. Paul starts off his book in the Colossians, which is trying to answer the question, what is spiritual maturity, by telling them, look, the first step to spiritual maturity is the ability to see God in all. You should be able to go to a wedding that uses the words God and prayer and the Bible and see God there. But you should also be able to go to a wedding who makes no mention of those things and be able to see the Christ shining through this ceremony of love just as equally. That is the first step toward spiritual maturity. God is the God of all things of this planet. God is not in opposition with this world, but God is in harmony with this world. One of the oldest ideas about God that we have is the omnipresence of God, that God is everywhere. Why are we so quick to point out then where God isn't? God is the God of all. Colossians 1:15 to 20 reads this, Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, all things have been created through him and for him. Jesus himself is before all things, and in Jesus all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in all things. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace through the blood of his cross. Once you are willing to accept that Jesus Christ can be found throughout time, throughout history, throughout the globe, then you are ready to hear Paul's radical thesis statement of Colossians. We find it in chapter 2, verses 6 and 7. Paul writes these words: "As you therefore have received Christ Jesus the Lord, continue to live your lives in him, rooted and built up in him and established in the faith, just as you were taught, overflowing with thankfulness." You see, the question is, what is spiritual maturity? And Paul's answer is, spiritual maturity is a life overflowing with thankfulness. At this time, I'd invite you to look at your own life. Is it overflowing with thankfulness? Would you describe yourself as a grateful person? Because Paul would tell you the highest summation of faith is the ability to look at your life and what you have been given and respond by saying thank you. Not just once, but to be overflowing with thankfulness. You want to know what it's like to grow in your faith? It means that you grow in gratitude toward yourself, toward the people you love, and toward those who you have a hard time loving. But there is even more depth to this statement. Because while we've established that Paul is writing to the people of Colossae, you have to ask the question, but where is Paul? And where is he writing from? And as we continue to read Colossians, it becomes apparent Paul is writing these words from prison. Now, we're not sure which prison he is writing from. We know that there are three major imprisonments in Paul's life. The first of which was Ephesus, the second of which was Caesarea, and the third of which was Rome. And while people will argue back and forth as to what the right imprisonment was that Paul wrote the letter of Colossians, I'm going to trust a man named N.T. Wright, who I consider to be the world's foremost authority on the life of Paul. N.T. Wright says that this was probably written, his best guess was the imprisonment at Ephesus. This happened sometime around 52 to 55 CE. But N.T. Wright says that this one imprisonment, Paul wrote three other letters. Yes, he wrote the book of Colossians there, but he also wrote the letter to the Ephesians, the letter to the Philippians, and the letter to Philemon. Now, Paul writes about this imprisonment in another letter, a letter to the Corinthians, the second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 1. He writes to these people, he says, "We do not want you to be unaware, brothers and sisters, of the affliction we experienced in Asia." This is the imprisonment that Paul is talking about. And then he talks about this affliction and what it did to his own personhood. He says in 2 Corinthians, "For we were so utterly, unbearably crushed that we despaired of life itself." Have you ever despaired of life itself? Have you ever felt like giving up? Have you ever felt like the world isn't just, the world isn't fair? That the world has stabbed you in the back for no good reason? Because that's what Paul was feeling. And imagine for a moment if we could go back in time to that jail cell. It's a dark, dank jail cell, and Paul is about to give up on life itself. And he receives word from Colossae that they are squabbling about foreskin on people's genitalia. And people are saying, you want to know what the ultimate message of Jesus Christ is? It's your ability to take that piece of skin off. And other people, these new believers, are saying, if that's it, then I'm not sure I want to be part of it. And he hears about this controversy, and he's asked to write a letter in response to the question, what is spiritual maturity? And here's a man who is borderline depressed. And he says, you want to know what spiritual maturity is? Spiritual maturity is a life overflowing with thankfulness. And it's here in this dank, dark jail cell that we realize there are two different kinds of gratitude. There is a gratitude without grieving, without darkness, and without pain. And it is naive and shallow. Have you ever turned on the radio and you landed on a Christian radio station and you instantly became annoyed because it felt cheesy? It felt superficial. It felt like it was wrong. Well, that's because the Christian radio station probably operates under the understanding that their radio station needs to be positive, uplifting, and family-friendly. The problem is, life isn't always positive, uplifting, and family-friendly. And so they talk about gratitude and the importance of always being positive, but it doesn't include any grieving, any darkness, or any pain, and it comes off as naive, shallow, cheesy, superficial. So if you've ever been frustrated, annoyed, or irritated by Christian radio and it's just sicky, sweet positivity on life, it's because it's gratitude that's not grounded in reality. It's gratitude without pain. But there is a second kind of gratitude. And there's a gratitude that does include grieving, that does include darkness, that does include pain. And it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And when we consider the life of Paul, here's a man who has gone through some of the deepest darkness, who has gone through some of the worst pain, who has gone through some of the most insufferable humanity, and yet is still willing to look back on his life and say, "Thank you for this gift." Isn't that what you want? The ability to have obstacles, waves, hardships come your way, and you find a way to say, "Oh, it hurts, but thank you for the beauty of my life." You see, I believe that what is implied by Paul's current status and being imprisoned and what he writes in Colossians is that spiritual maturity is a life that has felt and endured deep suffering, but then overflows with thankfulness. Spiritual maturity is a life that has felt deep suffering, but is overflowing with thankfulness. When I think of that spiritual maturity, I think of a man named Elie Wiesel. Unfortunately, Elie Wiesel passed away just 2 months ago. But when he was 16, his town was raided, and he and 15,000 of his Jewish neighbors were captured and sent in cattle cars to concentration camps. Elie Wiesel ended up at Auschwitz. He was then separated from his mother and sisters and was grouped together with his father. Elie Wiesel would never see his mother and sisters again. Now, once inside the camp, Elie Wiesel did his best to try and describe how horrible it actually was. But tries as he might, it seems nearly impossible to describe how horrific it must have been to watch German soldiers pick up babies and throw them into a fire. Not only that, but Elie Wiesel watched as his father died from dysentery and starvation. And there was a time when there was these people who betrayed the camp, who broke the rules. And so the German officers wanted to make an example out of these two men and a boy, so three people total. And so they brought all of the prisoners of Auschwitz to the main yard, and they were going to hang these three prisoners on a gallows. And as they were about to do it, they knocked out the stools from under them. They watched as two people died. But the boy was still alive because he didn't have enough weight to be hung by the rope. And so they were forced to watch this boy struggling for his life for what seemed like forever. And yet they couldn't do anything to help him. And Elie Wiesel tells a story about a guy who just a few rows behind him mumbled under his breath, "Where is God? Where is he?" And then he writes, "And I heard a voice within me answer him, 'Here he is. He is hanging here on the gallows.'" And Elie Wiesel realized at that time that his faith in God and the God he believed in was dead and hanging on the gallows. Can you really blame him for feeling the way that he did? How would you process the atrocities of a concentration camp if you held on to faith and were trying to reconcile that with what you saw? At this point, Elie Wiesel writes that it was nearly impossible for him to get up the next day, and he had given up on life. But shortly after that incident, his camp was liberated, and he was sent to live as a free man without the fear of persecution again. So Elie Wiesel, because he was only 16 or 17 years old, went to an orphanage. He spent the next couple of years there and then got a job as a tutor and then eventually got a job in music. And he waited 10 years to write about the horrors of Auschwitz. He wanted to get his words just right. And he wrote a book called Night that came out in 1955. And it was a book that opened the world's eyes to just how terrible the concentration camps had been. Now, what's fascinating in the book is he tells this story, but he doesn't ever justify it with his theology. And you may ask, why didn't he try and explain how a God could allow this terrible thing to happen? He would simply say, it is impossible to justify this Holocaust with theology. It was so evil that there's no way that you could justify it with any belief in God. But he said, the thing that we can do is we can recognize that there are people that are out there suffering and realize that our call and our God, whoever that God is calling us to move and get out in the world and stop that suffering, stop that oppression, whether they're Jewish or not, get out there and do something about it. Well, Elie Wiesel committed the next 30 years to doing this, to trying to raise awareness of when a government systemically persecuted a racial group or a religious group and was trying to kill them with mass efficiency. Elie Wiesel went around and tried to put a stop to it. Why? Because he had lived through it and he wished someone would have done the same for him. His work was so influential that in 1986, he won the Nobel Peace Prize. And during his acceptance speech, he said a few things that I found to be quite profound. He said, yes, I have faith. Faith in God and even in his creation. Without it, no action would be possible. And action is the only remedy to indifference, the most insidious evil of all. No one is as capable of gratitude as one who has emerged from the kingdom of night. We know that every moment is a moment of grace, every hour an offering. Not to share them would mean to betray them. And so during his acceptance speech, he said, yes, I have gone through the kingdom of night. Yes, I have gone through the horrors of how terrible human beings can be to one another. But it has opened my eyes to realize how grateful I am to a free, beautiful, and wonderful life. 14 years later, Elie Wiesel was asked for an interview by Oprah Winfrey. And Oprah asked him the question, what does it take to be normal again after having your humanity stripped away by the Nazis? Wiesel responded by saying, what is abnormal is that I am normal, that I survived the Holocaust and went on to love beautiful girls, to talk, to write, to have toast and tea and live my life. That is what is abnormal. Oprah then asked, does having seen the worst of humanity make you more grateful for ordinary occurrences? Elie said, yes, for me, every hour is grace. And I feel gratitude in my heart each time I can meet someone and look at his or her smile. Oprah then asked, despite all the tragedy you've witnessed, do you still have a place inside you for gratefulness? Elie said, absolutely. Right after the war, I went around telling people, thank you for just living. Thank you for being human. And to this day, he continued, the words that came most frequently from my lips are thank you. When a person doesn't have gratitude, he said, something is missing in his or her humanity. I'll say that again. When a person doesn't have gratitude, something is missing in his or her humanity. Here's a man who has lived through one of the worst evils in all of the history of humanity. And yet, despite all of that, he has found a way to include the darkness, the pain, and the suffering, and to be able to transcend it and turn it into gratitude. Isn't that what spiritual maturity is about? Don't you want that for your own life? Because if we were to take Paul seriously and believe that spiritual maturity is a life that has felt deep suffering but is overflowing with thankfulness. Spiritual maturity is not the ability to say, well, that's evil and that's right. Spiritual maturity is not the ability to say, well, that's of God and that isn't. Spiritual maturity is a life that has felt deep suffering but is overflowing with thankfulness. Everyone listening to this podcast right now has felt intense pain. Maybe you had to bury someone far too early. Maybe someone rejected you in a painful way. Maybe you were excluded based on the color of your skin. Whatever it is, we all carry pain with us, and some of us have more pain than others. But what the real spiritual journey is the ability to feel the pain, to grieve the pain, to groan and lament against the pain, but at the same time include it and allow it to teach you something about life and the way that you interact with others. And rather than choosing to be bitter about that pain that you have felt, to be bitter against God and humanity and the universe, maybe your journey is inviting you to thank God, thank the universe, thank your existence for having such wonderful memories before the tragedy. And how will that change you afterwards? Do you want to be a person who is filled with bitterness or who is filled with gratitude? Because Paul would challenge you to choose gratitude, to understand and to feel the pain, of course, but then to transform your bitterness toward gratitude and live a life that is overflowing with thankfulness. May you, my brothers and my sisters, live a life that overflows with gratitude. Grace and peace to all of you.